You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Can you tell me what that energy is? I love it. And you look a little crazed. Are you okay?
I feel a little crazy.
It's the laugh. It's like, are you okay? What's going on? That's so intense. What an arrival.
What an arrival. Last day of camp.
Oh, did you run and bring the kids to camp and you have to like go to Prospect Park and like run?
And I have to go to, I have to run to the city to do like a really big challenge in a minute. And I like just met with my professor to go over like one of my tests to be like, I want to know what I got wrong. It's really weird you guys don't tell us. She was like, yeah, we don't. It's so we don't have to redo the test. And I'm like, that's so dumb.
Oh, because they don't want you cheating?
Well, it's the vibe of like, we'll tell you what your score is, but we won't tell you which ones you got wrong. And that way we protect the integrity of the test so that in the future we can keep giving the test because no one knows what they got wrong.
And but I'm like, joke's on you because you don't learn
shit.
But wait,
aren't we supposed to learn?
Yeah, that's so fucked. That's so fucked.
I made her meet with me and tell me what I got wrong.
I have to tell you, last night I did something. I took an adult ballet class. Quinn, it was incredible. Incredible. I used to take ballet as a kid often, right? Like I was a ballet kid. So last night I was on ClassPass. It's nearby my house. It's like a 10-minute walk and it's adult teen drop-in. And it was like, it was an hour and a half. I got a bar. I did adagio. I did petit allegro. I did across the floor. We did like, and it was, it had been 10 years since I've taken a dance class like that. And it felt so good. Like I guess this is my new identity. I'm a ballet kid now. I'm going to go ballet core. It's like a whole thing. I'm doing it. It's great.
That's so fun.
It was
so fun.
It was like everything. Also,
I took a Zumba class yesterday, so I was feeling that energy too.
So you get it.
There was a really big controversy during the class.
What happened?
Well, so like we're all dancing and it's like a lot of women shaking their booties and some of them are bootylicious booties and a guy started peeping through the window in the weight room and he's like watching us and I didn't notice, like who cares? But then I guess the women got pissed because I saw him call a friend over to watch that was like where the line fully got crossed, I guess, and they stopped and they were like, that guy's watching us, we don't like it. And the teacher was a sub and he was this guy Caesar, and he was like, or Cesar, and he was like a little bit of like a sweet guy that you could tell was like, I want you to feel empowered and I don't want this to bother you, and is it bothering you? And everyone's like, and a lot of the women are like, yes. And he's like, okay. And you could tell he was like, I'm about to go yell at this big weight guy, which is uncomfortable for me.
I'm a Zumba teacher and I'm about to run at a guy who's like lifting weights.
And
that's tough.
And it was so intense and like it was crazy. And I'm standing next to this woman and she's turning to me and she's really upset. She's like, I'm 76 years old. If they want to watch, let them watch. And I was like, okay. And then she was like, I noticed the construction guys have stopped calling out to me. And I went up to them the other day and I said, hey, none of you said shit to me. I looking that bad? Am I looking that bad? And they were like, I'm sorry, ma'am. We will catcall you. And she just like kept. And then she got really pissed because the conversation went on too long. And she and I were kind of on the same boat, which we were like,
can we just go back to moving our bodies?
We would like to keep dancing, and it feels like this is lasting a really long time. So she and I were like, come on, let's dance, let's dance. And the teachers finally went back to dancing, but it was like, he did go have a talk with them and say, would you like to dance? Would you like to participate? Because if not, maybe you should find a way to work out because you're at the gym and not...
That's actually a pretty constructive way of dealing with it. I mean, I think listen, in those Zumba classes, like, you're really shaking your ass, you know? You're dancing. And also, like, you're in your gym clothes, you're vulnerable. Like, I understand.
Yeah, then the gym teacher, the instructor, he's like, well, I mess up here, but the gym that I work at, we had a guy filming, women, and we busted him. Fucked. We busted him, and he's not allowed to work out there anymore.
That's fucked.
Yeah, like, well, you, especially at the gym, you're like, I just want to be like, kind of like taking a risk, cutting loose, acting a little silly.
Yeah, acting a little crazy. Yeah, I do miss the, I was talking to a friend about the crunch gym yesterday. I said, there's nothing like a crunch, because she's moving. My friend who lives in I haven't talked to her in ages, and she's moving to Williamsburg. And she's like, there's no crunch in Williamsburg. I was like, there's nothing like that crunch. There's nothing like it. It's just the best. Wait, so did the summer schedule change and that's why there's a Zumba on Thursday? Was that the day class or was that?
It's a 10:30 class. It's always been there. We just usually go to the earlier stuff, but gotcha. I did go to it the other day. I had time. It was a blast and
it's so good to move your body. I think the ballet part, like, one, it does something to my brain. It was amazing. I hadn't taken a dance class, like I said, in like 10 years. And it was so cool doing the bar, like pliés, tendus, and all that stuff. And like how quickly it comes back. And I think what I also like about the class that I'm able to conceptualize as an adult or synthesize is that they give you combinations to remember. So it's like, not only is it like a physical workout, but also you're like memorizing the steps. And there's something about that like occupies my brain in a way that feels like when I'm doing it, I have to focus on like my body, the alignment, the next moves. And I think also it's like being a dancer growing up, I think there was so often times like you felt like you were competing or I felt like I was striving to impress someone. And I feel like last night what was so cool about it was like, I know I'm not going to be a prima ballerina. Although I'll be honest, in my mind, I was like, am I going to do ballet again? Am I going to like really go for it? But I'm an adult person and I can't strive to be something I'm not. And so there was something really freeing about not like, and I always found such enjoyment of ballet. And I think there are some, you know, obviously it gave me some weird body stuff, you know, like it usually does because teachers be crazy. But like this one, it felt so good. And I just felt like I was connecting to this like inner child part of me that like loved it growing up. And it wasn't a means to get somewhere else. It was just to enjoy a class. And that felt really special. And I just want to like urge our listeners, if there is something you did as a kid that you loved, try revisiting it.
Yeah.
Try revisiting it.
For sure. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's fun to try things. I baked a cake.
Oh, that delicious cake. Matt's party was so fun.
I baked a cake and I'm not good at baking cakes. And I have a friend, by the way, that bakes cakes.
You have a friend?
Listen.
I have a friend, by the way.
I've never seen a cake like this. Like, she does cakes that look like works of art. And on top of them, you'll tell her, like, I'm inspired by these colors or this flower or Bluey meets Star Wars. And she'll make the most insane piece of artwork you've ever seen. But then on top of it, you're like, what's in there? Is it just garbage? And she's like, glad you asked. It's dark chocolate dipped cornflake crusted strawberries and cream. And you're like, what? And she's like, that's this side. Anyway, if any of you live in the Bay Area, Sassy Malassi, hit her up because those cakes are mental.
Wow. Also, I know you just made up the like cornflake crusted dark chocolate strawberries and cream, but I got to tell you, that sounds delicious.
It is something like that. She does crazy stuff. She does pretzel inside her cakes. Like, she's amazing.
She's a star.
She's a star. She's a beast. My cake was very good, but I was like, I'm very aware of my limitations. But as Will said, this cake has integrity.
It does have integrity. It had chutzpah. And also protein. Because it was an almond cake.
Yes.
What I loved about Quinn left at the end of the night. Quinn goes, my intention was to give the cake to the kids and them to go, oh, this is weird, and give it to their parents.
And it was working.
And it was working.
Because I put rose in the whipped cream. And I didn't think the rose was... Did you see Koa's friend had a bite and she goes, is there shaving cream on this? And I was like, go Met.
Can I tell you though, I didn't, when I had it, the rose didn't feel overpowering. And sometimes I think if you put floral, it can, like, I thought it was so subtle. I barely, like, it wasn't overpowering at all. So I didn't think.
You know, when we went to Holi, they gave us like these samples of this really amazing, like rose chutney kind of thing, like rose jam. Mm. And that's what I used. I like just mixed a little of that in the cream when I whipped it. So it was like a perfect little hint.
In the cream when you whipped it. Mm-hmm. In the cream when you whipped it. I don't know why that sounds so sexual.
I whipped it.
In the cream when I whipped it.
Okay.
Live your life.
And that very same day, not to brag, but in addition to baking a cake, I got a pap smear. And so I really felt like
it was
an adult.
Wow. What a feminine day. And I think that feels very divinely feminine. A rose cake and a pap smear.
I loved, loved, loved going to get the pap smear because I hate getting a pap smear. But I never see my primary caregiver. This is like the third time I've seen her. And she is incredible. Like, I just love being with her. Where like, I say things like, she was like, anything happened that I should know about? And I go, I don't know. I got parvovirus. And she goes, gross.
Wait, I need a primary care. Where is she at?
Midtown. She's for performers. She's amazing. Oh. Can I tell you the conversation I had with her? I said, yes. So you must be freaking out because a lot of people that see you have Medicaid, like me. And she was like, yeah, it's not looking great. And I was like, yeah. And she goes, but you know, I keep thinking I'm in charge of me. I can go back to a bartering system if I want. You bake me a dozen cookies, I give you an abortion.
I need to go to her.
I'm obsessed with you.
I need to go to her. Also, as a primary care, she can give pap smears?
Yeah. She can do a lot of things.
You know what? She sounds like a fucking whiz with a speculum.
She does whatever she wants.
She does whatever she
knows.
You know what? Maybe that's what
we need. And I said she was so fast. Like, the pap smear was crazy. I've never had a pap smear be that, like, unintrusive. And it was so great that I said to her, that's it? And she goes, yeah, what do you want me to stay down there?
I hope she takes my insurance. I hope and I pray she takes my insurance.
DEAD dead. I loved her.
I had a gynecologist that also, I think I've told you about, Allegra Cummings was my gynecologist's name.
Oh, which, you know, Bix is getting his
gynecologist.
His vasectomy, and his doctor is Dr. Seaman.
I love it. I want doctors to have, what is this doctor's name in Midtown? We can bleep it.
I don't know how to pronounce it, but I'll text it to you.
Okay, thank you. Because I was like, maybe that's
Layla. I would just call her Layla.
Dr. Layla?
Dr. God. Layla said she doesn't care if she goes to jail. So that's also why we have to
bitch
beep
a
it.
TV
because
show.
She's really great. She's
I
radical.
I really want her on air. I think she needs to be like, what are we doing? Move over, Dr. Oz, Dr. Phil. Let's get Dr. Layla up there.
Up in the house. I have to tell you another funny thing that happened that's going to crack you up. So I was at work the other day, and a woman walked up to me. I was like sitting on a chair, and I gave her the look over, and I noticed, I was like, cool shorts, cool shirt. And I was like,
cool
and
things.
Then I got to her face, and she was very beautiful and had really pretty gray hair. And I was just like, oh my gosh, you're so pretty. You're such like goals. And I was about to ask her where she got her clothes, because I was like, I'm obsessed with you. And then we locked eyes, and I realized in the moment we locked eyes that she was crazy. And then she said, what color are your eyes? And I was like, brown. And then she turned to my coworker and goes, what color are your eyes? And she goes, also brown. And she goes, you both are so lovely. You're just doing it. And I thought, And then I realized how dirty her legs were. And like, I suddenly took it all in and was like, I just almost asked a homeless crazy woman where she buys her clothes because I want to look like her. Isn't that... I turned to my coworker after, and I go, and I told her what had gone through my mind. And she goes, oh, interesting. I registered her as like a homeless woman approaching us. And I was like, I registered her as
a fashionista.
Goals, as hashtag goals. Fashionista. Want to look just like her. Wanted everything like hers. And didn't take it in correctly in a way that makes me question everything. But I was like, am I crazy or was she really beautiful? And she's like, huh, no, she was really pretty. And I'm like, yeah, right?
It's sort of like if I could smash cut that to how you entered the chat today.
You're like, you're getting there. You're getting there.
Can I say goals achieved?
Goal attained. Goal attained. I do look insane. I see what I look like. I'm going to fix it before I go to work. I'm glad we're doing this. It's like a rough draft for my approach for the day because I see how crazy. I don't think about how crazy I look, and then I see how crazy I look, and I'm like, okay, I have to go to work. I need to change everything.
It was the, like, you started laughing maniacally when you walked in. I was like, maybe there was something in her when she asked what color eyes you have. Maybe you guys sort of, like, transferred
energies. Oh my god, we Freaky Friday.
I think you
this
Freaky
is great.
You're like, god, I wish I was her.
This is great.
She's like, I wish I was her. It's good to talk to this woman in you. So thank you so much for joining us. By the way, you're listening to Truly
Darkly
Creepily.
Oh, and I want to tell them something.
Tell them anything. Oh, about our social media.
Oh, well, it's down right now. Don't worry about it. It's not like you guys were engaging with it. Relax.
Although a friend of mine was like, so you shared that AI picture of yourself? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, brave.
Brave.
I was like, if I'm going to be traumatized, I have to share it to the people because otherwise it's for nothing.
Of course. Shared trauma is the best trauma. I have to tell you that I heard a piece of advice that I'm trying to remember to tell everybody, and a podcast is a good way to do that. If you are in a situation where you're getting kidnapped or you think you might get kidnapped, mm-hmm. or you're in the woods and you're like, I think I'm starting to get lost. Like, I think I might turn into one of those stories of somebody that like hopefully survived something. Mm-hmm. But let's say you're like, uh-oh, I might lose service. Uh-oh, my battery's low. Any of the above sort of combo packs happen to you. I think like a tendency is like, who should I call? Mm-hmm. And it's the first, I learned, this is so great. The first thing you do, if you have any bars, is go in and change your voicemail. So you use your own voicemail to broadcast whatever message you want. And now you're done in the sense that should anything happen, you can't call the person, they don't pick up. You are unable to like dial 911, any of the above. You have now beaconed yourself. And it's so smart because everyone's going to call you eventually. Smart. And you've sent whatever beacon you can, whether that's like a marker of where you are and what's happening, any of the above. It's just like, think of everything you would maybe want to like broadcast in that moment. And the first thing you do is change your voicemail.
Brilliant.
This is great, right?
Fucking brilliant.
This is great intel.
Really brilliant. Okay. Wow.
So I did want to share that because I was like, I'm not that smart, apparently. Like, it would not occur to me. I'd, like, start calling people for sure. Using my phone to, like,
brilliant.
Do GPS. I would do, like, a million things to run the battery down before I would think to do that thing. And that's the first thing you should do. Because you can even send a voice. You don't have to make it really emergency heavy. You could just be like, I don't know what's going on, but right now this is where I am. And if your voicemail says that, that's not, like, who cares? You can change it back if nothing bad happens. You're not going to, do you know,
my voicemail, I haven't even listened to it, and I've never changed my voice. I don't remember the last time I changed my voicemail. I love this. If ever I'm in danger emotionally,
right?
If I'm feeling extra anxious, I'm just gonna change.
I'm at the store. I'm at Key Food.
I do not know what to do in here.
Aisle 9.
Guys, I'm on New York Times 5 stars. I'm debating between a couple recipes. I need help.
Let's just make it a habit to always change our voicemail over and over to ask for assistance.
The fact that we haven't is kind of weird.
Lazy.
All lazy. Right.
Lifestyle change. Who's up?
It's me.
It's her. Me.
It's me. I've been watching The Bear. Have you been watching it?
No, I started season 3, and I think the first 2 episodes, I was like, is this a good show anymore? Sorry, Bear.
I feel like a lot of people are feeling, okay.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart. Check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states, thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab-tested, real results. Go to Mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's Mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
So I was watching The Bear, and in season 4, as you know, it takes place in Chicago, and brags, that is where I am from. And it's the 4th season, but Carmi goes and he visits Oak Park, Illinois, and he visits the Frank Lloyd Wright house. So there's a lot of, as you know, Frank Lloyd Wright is like a big guy, a big architecture guy. Mm-hmm. He's probably what they would say is America's most famous architect. Mm-hmm. By the way, I got this information from Crime Museum, All That's Interesting, HuffPost, History.com, PBS. And so he's from Chicago. And so a lot of his designs are in Chicago, but they're all over the world, right? Or all over, I think the world, but all over the U.S. certainly. Like, I don't know if you know this, but the Guggenheim was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. One of his big famous houses is Falling Water, which is in Pennsylvania. There's a house of his. There's like a room of his on display at the Met, which I do love going to that room. And it's a home he built in Minnesota that has since been demolished, but they rebuilt it in the Met. So there's like a living room that is designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. Mm-hmm. So it's the early 1900s. He's married. He's got 6 kids. He's got so many houses, but he's a famous guy.
Yeah.
It's 1903, and he is commissioned by his neighbor, Edwin Cheney, to design his home. And he's like, great. I love being commissioned to design homes. That is my job. So he's working there, and he meets his wife, this woman, Martha Mama, M-A-M-A-H, as they call her, his little nickname, Borthwick Cheney. And here's what's actually really funny is I'm writing a movie right now, and we have British characters in it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not kidding you. I read this name and I was like, wait, what? We made up the last name Borthwick, and here it is in all for real. Its glory. For real. And I'm like, okay, maybe we need to change that. But maybe it's also something that stuck in my brain because I had read about this case a while ago. So Mama had met Catherine, Frank Lloyd Wright's house. Like, they kind of hung in similar circles. And then Edwin asks Frank Lloyd Wright to design their home. And so they all kind of know each other. And Frank Lloyd Wright and Mama, well, some flirtation starts happening, okay? They start to have feelings for each other. And it's not great, right? He's, like, working for her husband. He's married. She's married with 2 kids. He's got 6 kids. It's a lot. Now, a little bit about Mama. Mama has both her bachelor's and master's from the University of Michigan, which I just think is noteworthy because it's the early 1900s. And mm-hmm. I think that's pretty insane, pretty rare. And so she got both of those degrees and she works as a librarian. The two of them, they end up falling in love. And what do? They're like, we can't stay here. Our love is too strong. We need to be together. So they run away to Europe, and she ends up filing for divorce while she stays in Europe. And Frank Lloyd Wright is like, hey, Catherine, can you hook me up with a divorce? And she's like, no, I'm not interested. She just refuses. So he's not divorced. She's divorced. She drops the Cheney from her name. She's just Mama Borthwick. And so she comes back to the U.S. and Frank is like, you know what? I got to build us a place to go. So he builds them a home and studio in Spring Green, Wisconsin, and he names it Taliesin, which is in honor of a Welsh bard. But the press dubbed this area Love Cottage and Castle of Love because he is a famous man. And so the press...
I don't love that.
No, the press get wind of it. And so they're like, hey, wow, look at this. Look at this sort of sensational scandal that's happening in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
So he builds this in 1911. She moves in, and the hubbub around the town of Spring Green, Wisconsin is not good. The townspeople basically have their pitchforks. They're pissed. Mm-hmm. They hear about that and they're like, wait a minute. They're not welcoming. The superintendent of the school tells a reporter, the scandal is bound to have a demoralizing effect on the school children of the community. It is an outrage to allow young men and women and boys and girls to grow up in the belief that a man and a woman can go disregard the marriage bonds. Pissed. There were even threats from townspeople that they would tar and feather them. The townspeople also called for an arrest. Frank, meanwhile, famous guy, he's like, I don't care. Not one bit. In fact, he really doubles down. He says in an interview, two women were necessary for a man of artistic mind. One to be the mother of his children and the other to be his mental companion, his inspiration and soulmate. To another reporter,
rough.
Really rough. To another reporter, he's like, laws and rules are made for the average. The ordinary man cannot live without rules to guide his conduct. It is infinitely more difficult to live without rules, but it is what the really honest, sincere, thinking man is compelled to do.
That's an interesting thing to say. I got to unpack that a little, but...
Yeah, it feels like he's kind of like thumbing his nose
at them.
He's smart, so
he's putting up a good argument.
It just seems like a narcissist to be like, rules are made for ordinary men, but me, I'm a free, thinking, lovely, intelligent, brilliant man, and I can't be bogged down.
I just feel like he's like about to go get a drink with Adrian Brody and be like, let's work on that speech.
Do you think Adrian Brody is going to play Frank Lloyd Wright? Totally going to play Frank Lloyd Wright.
And it'll be a sequel to The Brutalist, and it'll be called The Narcissist.
But it's true. It's April 15th, 1914, and Frankie, which I'm sure that I'm calling it, but it's fine. Frankie L. W., he's in Chicago working on a design for the Midway Gardens, which will be another big institution of his that will be a landmark later on in life. And Mama's with her two kids, Martha and John. There's some reports that they're 9-11. There's some reports that they're 8 and 12. Either way, that's their age, around thereabouts.
Either way, that's both right.
That's both right.
At some point.
At some point, they turn from 11 to 12. They turn from 8 to 9. I don't know when it is, but, you know, I guess the press isn't, you know, looking up, aren't able to verify ages at this time. So Mama is sitting with her two kids. They're sitting down for lunch. They're on the porch. And from what the house is described is there's a 25-foot-long passageway from like where the porch is to where a bunch of other people, the laborers or the draftsmen, they're prepared to gather and eat lunch themselves. So it's like a big, long passageway. And so they're served by 30-year-old servant, Julian Carlton, who's from Barbados. He's a handyman. He's a servant. He does housework at Taliesin. And his wife, Gertrude, does most of the cooking. So he's serving food to all of the people there. And so the workers are eating their soup. And Carlton tells his wife, Gertrude, to leave. And the guys are all eating. And he comes to the door and he asks for gasoline to clean a rug. And he's given permission to go get some gasoline. And at the table is 19-year-old draftsman Herbert Fritz, and he notices something strange. He sees the doors close, and he hears a swish as though water was thrown through the screen door. Then we saw some fluid coming under the door. It looked like dishwater. It spread out all over the floor. Just as I was about to remark the fact, a streak of flame shot under my chair, and it looked like the whole side of the room was on fire.
Yeah.
Soon after, what they find out is that, would you say from Barbados, Julian or Julian?
I would say Julian, but we had a whole episode that they sang to Hulea. So, like, we are not, like,
we don't know. I'm going to say Julian. So what they don't realize is that before this gasoline that we now know as gasoline was spilled, Julian had locked all of the doors. And in his hand, he has a hatchet. And so some of the people, as soon as, like, 19-year-old Fritz, he sees this flame. And he just immediately jumps out a window and rolls down a hill, extinguishing the flames. He looks back into the house and he sees the fire just spreading. And Julian is using a hatchet against his coworkers. So if they're trying to break through the barricaded door, or if they're trying to escape through a window, he's just chasing them with the hatchet. Mm-hmm. We will find out later that he had gone back to the porch with Mama and the two kids, and he had hatcheted them as well, like nearly severing their heads. Really traumatic stuff. So Herbert is outside. He's like trying to get the flame off. Meanwhile, the master carpenter, Billy Weston, who built Taliesin, and the landscape gardener, David Lindblom, they're able to escape. And they are, like, Lindblom is super on fire. They pat him out. The two of them run half a mile to the nearest house that has a phone to call for help. They call for help. The town people rush to the scene. They find Mama, her two kids. They find two workers and 13-year-old boy who was there with his father, burned and dead. Lindblom, who was also burned, who ran to the house, he ended up succumbing to his injuries. So in all, seven people died. Mm-hmm. Them, I'll just name them: Mama, John and Martha, her kids, Emil Brodel, Thomas Brunker, David Lindblom, and then one of the workers' sons, Ernest, who was 13 years old. Hours after the attack, Julian was discovered barely conscious inside the basement furnace of the home. He had swallowed muriatic acid, and he never gave a reason why he attacked everyone. He died 7 weeks later, and the cause of death is starvation. His wife was interviewed.
Starvation? Seriously?
Yeah.
Crazy.
His wife would later, I was wondering if he basically went on a hunger strike and wouldn't talk to anyone, or from swallowing the acid, he couldn't eat anything. So mm-hmm. maybe that's why. But 7 weeks feels like a very long time to live in that way. His wife would later recall that he became increasingly paranoid in the weeks before the attack, and he would keep a hatchet in a bag next to his bat. That's like a really tongue twister. Twister. He would keep a hatchet in a bag next to his bed. A witness would later say that, would say Lindblom, who ended up passing away, who's the one who ran to the other house to call for help, mm-hmm. who died from his burns. A witness would say that he mentioned that if anyone around there ever did him any dirt, he would send him to hell in a minute. Additionally, this is a black man, right? Julian is a black man. And so there were rumors of workers possibly directing racial slurs at him. And there was a dispute about him a few days earlier saddling a horse. Another theory is that one of the surviving workers said that Mama had mentioned that the Carltons, both Julian and Gertrude, were being let go. And the killers, and Gertrude would later confirm that they were due to take a train back to Chicago that night. Like I said before, the town was not very welcoming to this family. So some people, unfortunately, used it as some sort of like retribution for them living in sin. Neighbors pointed to the tragic ruin of the Kingdom of Love as the strongest argument that the avenging angel still flies. What's interesting is that Frank Lloyd Wright ends up writing a letter to his neighbors, mm-hmm. talking kind of like a eulogizing his mistress and sort of contextualizing what happened in his eyes. And I thought what was so interesting about this letter and why I want to read some excerpts about it is before, when I mentioned that he was like, a man needs a wife and a mistress, you know, rules are meant for ordinary men. This letter was like much, much more thoughtful about it. And in it, In it, he wrote that wives were considered property of their husbands and that what Mama did was incredibly grave, or what Mama did was incredibly brave. Mm-hmm. And he actually wrote, quote, "She felt that she did more for her children in holding high above them the womanhood of their mother than by sacrificing it to them." Mm-hmm. And in her life, the tragedy was that it became necessary to choose the one or the other. Which I thought was really fascinating because it does probably speak to the early 1900s of this woman who might not have been satisfied or happy in her marriage. And she chose to pursue love in a way and divorce her husband. And she thought she'd be a better example for her children in doing just that. And Frank Lloyd Wright is like coming to bat for her in this eulogy, which I just thought was like really nuanced. And I felt to be very brave of her in, you know, think looking at this. He ends the letter with, "She is dead. I have buried her in the little chapel burying ground of my people, beside the little son of my sister, a beautiful boy of 10, who loved her and whom she loved much. And while the place she lived with me is a charred and blackened ruin, the little things of our daily life gone, I shall replace it all little by little, as nearly as it may be done. I shall set it all up again for the spirit of the mortals that lived in it and loved in it. We live in it still. My home will still be there." He would later say that he buried her in an unmarked grave because why mark the spot where desolation ended and began? He ended up rebuilding Taliesin by the end of 1914. The residential wing was rebuilt, and by the end of the year, he moved on. He announced his love for another woman who wrote him a condolence letter on the matter. Guess he really does need two women. The two would get married in 19...
clear about that.
He was very clear that he had, you know, he had things that he wanted. The two would end up getting married in 1923 when his wife finally agreed to divorce him. But in 1925, Taliesin burned to the ground again, but this time for faulty wiring. He rebuilt it again, and it remains in Wisconsin and is a National Historic Landmark. And that is the story of how Frank Lloyd Wright writes... How Frank Lloyd Wright's mistress.
Everything's a tongue twister today.
It's so hard. Frank Lloyd Wright in a hatchet in a bag by the bed.
In a hatchet in a bag by the bed.
Taliesin.
Tree in the ground and the green grass grew all around, and the green grass grew all around.
Beep, beep. So yeah, that's the story that I wanted to tell of how Frank Lloyd Wright's mistress was killed by her servant.
Wow.
And locked in. That just is the scariest bit, is that he locked everyone and burned them. Ugh, not good.
Terrible way to go. Terrible.
Really
that's
bad.
So sad.
And clearly this person was struggling from some mental health issues.
Yeah. You don't run around hatcheting children otherwise.
No. No. Also, soup for a lot of people's last meal. Kind of sad. Shouldn't
say that. I
feel
like if it was Kristen from Top Chef making it, I always, like, have been curious. She makes a lot of soups and people are like, and now she's the host and, like, we just know she's doing well, and every time she made a soup, people would be like, this is a crazy soup, and I felt like I was like, I really want to try this broad soup.
I just, if you ask anyone, like, their final meal, I want my
final meal to be a Top Chef challenge.
But what if it's bad? You wasted
your
last...
It's not gonna be a quick fire.
God. I want Iron Chef. I want Bobby Flay. Really specific. I want a Rachel Ray 30-minute meal.
I want Buddha. Buddha.
Buddha?
You know?
Oh, I don't know.
He won like twice. He has Huso or something as his restaurant now. And I follow him on Instagram. And it's a lot of like beautiful, like smoking caviar dishes. It's very fancy.
I'm watching The Bear, and I will say the food of it all, it does do something to your brain where you're like, well, I guess I need to make a full-on coursed meal.
Yeah.
I guess I need to go 100%. Have a tasting meal.
Yeah.
And I'm like making leftovers or whatever I have in my fridge.
It does make eating hard because you're like, what I'm doing is sad and what you're doing is real. This is a recent, ongoing, current edition story, and I got a ton of articles from the New York Times, and it seems like the lead reporter is Mike Baker covering most of it because it's a lot of New York Times articles, pretty much all by him. And then some information from a lot of these articles also that I had read were quoting, I guess, some specials that are now on Peacock and on Oxygen. So
there's some I didn't watch them,
but right. There was a lot of things I read that talked about them. We're talking about a case that happened in Moscow, Idaho, that is near the University of Idaho. And the people that I'm going to be talking about are and were students. Kaylee Gonclaves is a senior majoring in general studies at the College of Letters, Arts, and Social Sciences, and she was supposed to graduate in December, and then she was going to go to Austin, Texas to work at a marketing firm. Madison Mogan was studying marketing and was Kaylee's best friend, and they've been best friends forever since they were in sixth grade, and she was going to move to Boise. Zanna Kernodle was a junior majoring in marketing. She is dating a gentleman named Ethan Chapin, who majored in recreation, sport, and tourism management, and they had been dating since spring. On November 12th, 2022, Kaylee and Madison are at a sports bar, and Zanna and Ethan are at a fraternity party with Ethan's fraternity. At 2 in the morning, they all live together with a couple of other people in a house near the university, and at 2 in the morning they get home. Right before 4:30 in the morning, Dylan Mortensen, one of their roommates, sees a man wearing a mask walking in the hallway outside of her bedroom. She is drunk from a night of being out, and she, part of her is like, is that a firefighter? Like, she tries to make sense of what she's seen, mm-hmm. and part of her does not even believe that what she's seen is real. She texts one of her roommates upstairs, one of the people that I listed before, and they don't text back. But she writes, what's going on? They don't write anything, so then she starts texting one of the other roommates that she believes to be home, Bethany Funke, or Funk? It's F-U-N-K-E.
Funke. I'm just thinking of Arrested Development.
Totally. Well, she texts Bethany and she writes, I'm freaking out. And she says, nobody's answering upstairs that I'm texting. And I saw somebody wearing a ski mask almost. And Bethany's like, why don't you run downstairs to my bedroom so we can be together? It's better than being alone. So she runs downstairs, gets in bed with Bethany, and they try to text the other roommates. They're not getting a text back. And at 10:23 in the morning, Dylan sends more text messages to Kaylee, to Madison. Are you awake? Please answer. Are you up? Nothing. One of their friends comes to the house that morning and finds Zanna, and they call 911 and they say, one of our roommates was drunk last night and isn't waking up. And also, we saw a weird man in our house last night, we think. The police show up and they discover Zanna has been stabbed to death. So has Ethan, her boyfriend. And in another room, Kaylee and Madison are also found dead. All of these kids are like 20 and 21 years old.
They're so young.
All killed. The killer made some mistakes. There's some video surveillance of a vehicle circling the neighborhood. There's cell phone activity that shows that he went to that area a few hours before anything happened and then turned off the phone during the killings. He also leaves, the biggest mistake is he leaves the sheath of the knife he uses at the scene of the crime, and there is DNA on it. They do run the DNA through the databases. They don't find a hit. So this is something controversial that ends up happening. They go to do the DNA profiles that you can find in databases that mm-hmm. have consented to law enforcement seeing that, but they don't find any information there either. They don't get a hit. And then the FBI investigators decide that we're going to compare it to a couple of databases we're actually not supposed to or allowed to. GED Match and MyHeritage. This is a violation of Justice Department policy, where they're only supposed to look in the databases that have expressly right. said to that they the users, yeah, that have told the users that it can be used that way. And these two sites have not done that. So it's illegal, essentially. But they get a hit. And it lands on Brian Koberger, who is a PhD student studying criminology. Dr. Catherine Ramsland gets a phone call. She is one of the most well-known experts on serial killers in our nation. And she's also a professor of forensic psychology. She's written about a bunch of killers, BTK killer. She wrote a book called How to Catch a Killer, The Mind of a Murderer. Somebody calls her and says, do you know that your student just got arrested for stabbing a bunch of kids, for killing a bunch of people? And she's like, what? No, it couldn't be. Brian? No, this kid was really polite. He was really engaged with the material, but in a way where it felt like he really wanted a career. I'm not blindsided. I understand that people might take my class to learn how to be a criminal or something, or to know more about that. That is not a vibe I got from him at all. Just wait. There's going to be, I'm sure he has an alibi. And she waits, and then the alibi comes out, which is he says, I was driving around. And she's like, whoa, that's not an alibi. And
no one can corroborate that.
We've talked enough about crimes that Brian knows that's not an alibi. What a thing to say. Brian Koberger moved to Pennsylvania in June to get this PhD at Washington State University, which is a 15-minute drive from Moscow, Idaho. And like
Wait,
I said...
Wait, did you say Pennsylvania?
He moved from Pennsylvania to Washington, yeah.
Thank you.
And he was studying criminology, as I said, and he'd studied under this expert in serial killers, and he had written papers about how you analyze crime scenes. But he doesn't have a totally clean rap sheet in the sense that in his academic program, he had gotten in trouble. He was a teaching assistant, and women were complaining about him, saying that it seemed like he hated women and was unfair to them. And he also had a altercation with one of his professors, just verbal, but they were noticing some behavioral stuff, and they were like, we're not going to use you as a teaching assistant anymore. Even though they find out that his DNA matches the DNA on the knife sheath, it takes a long time. So it's not till December that he's arrested. And so he's finished his semester and gone home to be with his parents in Pennsylvania. When he drives home, he gets stopped by police twice for tailgating. But in the meantime, after that's happened and he's gotten home, he's changed his car registration. He's tried to delete his search history, which includes shopping for knife sheaths on Amazon, I guess, to replace the knife sheath that he left behind. Authorities don't ever find the knife, by the way. In fact, they don't find anything, really. There's no evidence in his home, in where he was living, his apartment. His car is so clean that they can't find anything there. But what they do have are these cell phone records I told you about. And the cell phone records show that he was really close to the street where he would end up murdering those four children 23 times in the months leading up to it.
Wow.
And they talk about how with serial killers, sometimes it's a game to them. It's hunting. And we are not sure what his relationship is with these people. It's really hard for them to find any links. They do know that Madison and Zanna were waitresses at a Moscow restaurant that had maybe he had been to before. If you search, once they're searching all his internet history and trying to find any rationale, they know that there was a Reddit user with his name that asked people, will you take a survey about crimes you've committed? And he says that he just wants to learn about people's thoughts and emotions and actions from the beginning to the end of the crime, and that he is a student investigator, which he was. So I don't know. That didn't, I guess, raise any flags. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm a student studying criminology, and this is a question I have. But now that we know what he's done, it begs other questions. And what we now know happened is that he entered the home of these kids at 4 in the morning and he stabbed Maddie Mogan and Kaylee Gonclaves. Kaylee was visiting Maddie and staying in Maddie's room. And then he went downstairs, maybe just to leave the house, and ran into Zanna on the second floor and killed her and her boyfriend, Ethan, who was asleep in her room. The evidence that they were planning to show in the trial are surveillance videos, phone records, bank records that show his purchases of things at Sporting Goods, Under Armour, Walmart. And alarmingly, there's a selfie he took of himself. It's him giving a thumbs up. And the reason they were going to include that is that there was a witness that said the person that did this had bushy eyebrows in the selfie he took after. He has bushy eyebrows. So I think that's why they were going to show it. But to the victim's parents, they're reacting to it saying, I know that the timeline of when this was taken, and I think that he had just gone back to the crime scene, realized that he was going to get away with it because at that point no one had called the police maybe. And so it's like a trophy, this like selfie of like, got away with it, thumbs up. There was a plea hearing and his parents are there and they're wrecked. And the family's parents are there and they're destroyed. And it's a very sad room to be in. And he's pleading guilty for a plea deal. And the judge says, are you pleading guilty? Are you pleading guilty because you are guilty? And he said, yes. And the good thing about him doing the plea deal is that Dylan and Bethany, who survived and must have,
they don't have to
bizarre
go
survivor's and, guilt, but they don't have to go recount like,
seeing
someone in a mask, going downstairs. Like, I feel like they must have a lot of feelings.
I think going through a trial is a traumatic thing.
Yeah.
I think it's not easy for the family as well. Like, nothing is easy for the family. And most importantly is you want justice to be served. And the idea that the evidence, all of that stuff will be rehashed in a public forum, and considering the amount of press this already received, like, I can't imagine that would be helpful for the family.
Yeah. For his plea deal, he would be imprisoned for life with no opportunity for parole. So at the sentence hearing, they're not going to be able to impose anything stricter than that. But the families of these victims are going to have their chance to say what they want to say.
There will be a sentencing hearing.
Yeah. And they wanted, I guess the defense team wanted to rule out the death penalty because Brian has ASD as well.
Mm.
And speaking, so I think everybody's like, what is the motive? So everyone's looking through this guy's history and his life. And one of the things they point out is that when he was 15, he was diagnosed with a condition that's basically visual snow. So that's where you see, you know, like static on a TV. It's like your eyes do that. And that condition can cause really high rates of anxiety and depression. And then there was an online forum about it that he was posting on where he said he found no joy in life and felt like he could do whatever he wanted with little remorse and said, something is wrong with me. I am just a blank soul. A lot of women have come out since this happened and said, I know that guy. A woman named Haley was like, I went on a date with that guy. We matched on Tinder and he came home with me and he kept trying to touch me and tickle me in weird, creepy ways. I didn't like it. I went to the bathroom and pretended to throw up so that he would leave. And then he texted me the next day. Thanks for the date. I had a wonderful time. You have great birthing hips.
Not what you want to hear. In many ways.
Certainly.
There's a
not.
Lot of reasons you don't want to hear that.
And then a bartender is like, oh, he used to come into the bar and he would get really pissed when women would reject him. And then one of his classmates, Holly, comes forward and says, I got the weirdest text from him. So like, I met him at a party. I felt bad for him. He was kind of awkward. So we talked a little bit. And then I got a text from him the next day that said, hey, I am pretty sure we spoke about hiking trips yesterday. I really enjoy that activity. So please let me know. Thanks. And she's like, it's just off. Like, it's not anything to super remark on, but she's
totally.
Like, this I think guy's anything like overly formal. Like, he doesn't have a lot of social skills.
Right.
Again, he was diagnosed with ASD, so he's missing social cues. And then a retired FBI agent hearing these stories comes forward to be like, it really does seem like Brian Koberger had a lot of traits of an incel and somebody that can't stand, that is enraged by rejection by women and has a really high self-worth, which leads to narcissistic personality traits. So we'll never know, obviously, why he did it. The questions we come away with are also related to this DNA thing, which is a pretty interesting controversy in the sense that,
'cause it worked,
people have said, you know? We're teaching law enforcement that the rules don't matter by this going the way it went. We're saying don't worry about the rules.
I mean, that's been a lesson we've been teaching for a long time.
Yes. And then other people have said, well, we're not going to do it all the time, but if it's a really serious case where it's a quadruple murder,
a mean to an end. Yeah.
And they said, forward and said, if we had not caught him, we will never know. Thank God.
How many, what he would have done. I do think, I mean, I was on the road with Psychology of Serial Killers when a lot of this stuff was happening, and because it was December of last year that he was in jail. And so by February, we just knew a little more information. And the forensic psychologist I traveled with, she was like, you know, I think he's a budding serial killer. It's not, it wasn't a matter of if he did it again, it was when he would do it again. And so there's a lot of people that are like, now it's kind of, this is like a very weird analogous situation, which is to say, do you know that feeling when like you have a friend who looks through her partner's phone and then like finds that he's cheating on her? Mm-hmm. And you're like, you shouldn't look through people's phone, but it worked. And yet, he was cheating. So it's that feeling. It's like a very, it's, I mean, on a much grander scale, but you're like, ah, oh, you shouldn't have, like, I've had friends that have been like, I shouldn't have looked, but I did find something. And you're like, yeah, tricky. It's a tricky ethical dilemma. And I'm sure the nice thing is, well, was there, and so there was like no other evidence tying him to this besides that DNA.
Yeah, they couldn't figure out how he knew them or anything like that. But it feels like he was watching them for a long time. And, you know, I would say that it does seem like his primary targets were Madison and Kaylee, because he did kill them first. And then on the way down, it's like, I think he maybe just ran into Xana and then killed her and Ethan. And if you think about it in those terms, they're beautiful, tan, blonde girls, like a cartoon image of a gorgeous college girl, where if you think of him then in as an incel and you speculate that that has to do with it, it would just be a picture of the kind of woman that's rejecting him all the time, or that he wishes he could be with, or that he like decided to take in some way, but he took their life instead. And one thing that was a Daily Mail article, so, you know, grain of salt, but I think they got it from one of the documentaries I mentioned, was a story about how during the exact times that they were being murdered, a close friend of theirs there was a couple that woke up in the middle of the night in that neighborhood. They live really close by and they're friends with them. And they went to they both woke up at the same time and went to go lock the door, and they never locked the door. And one of them went downstairs to lock it and saw the other one locking it. And it was just like a feeling, something dangerous is happening. And they're like, I've never locked the door, but something was pulling me toward doing it. And then there was a student driver that was being a sober driver that night. Mm-hmm. And so he was out around 4 and dropping people off close to where that happened. And he just had like a sick feeling. He was like, something's off tonight. I don't know why. It just, like he said, it just felt silent. It felt like I just started rushing to get people home, and I didn't know why. It was just like a feeling. I don't know. It was interesting to hear these kids come forward, and you don't know how much like hindsight is 2020. So now they think they had that feeling, or they're attaching something to it. But
still,
so terrifying.
Wow. I mean, it is a precarious legal situation, but I am very glad that person was caught, because God knows he would just do it. He would do it again.
Yeah, it definitely feels like he would have. It's just such an upsetting thing. It's such an upsetting thing to also hear about him being 15 and being like, I think something's wrong with me, and never finding the help that he needed. mm-hmm. to deal with those feelings.
Right.
And it just got out of control. But I think it is good that he was caught, and that
I think it's good that he pled guilty. Off the like the fact that we, what I also think too, it's like we know that if anybody were to get the death penalty, which I would imagine that if they took this to trial, he probably would. I think there's like a lot. Like I can't imagine this person getting a fair trial. Also, because the media attention around this case also is so crazy.
Yeah.
So the fact that we were able to take away, like, he also, I think from what I read, he's like, he can't appeal anything. Mm-hmm. He signed something that this is the decision. I cannot appeal. Mm-hmm. I'm happy with my, like, because we know that if someone were to get the death penalty, we know the appellate process, the appealing process is incredibly costly, and it takes a long, long time. And I think that have him just be put in jail for the rest of his life is probably the best option.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
those poor families, those poor girls.
It's such a sad story. It's such a sad story. I hope the families get whatever they can from it in terms of closure. But yeah. It's really, these kids were like, they were just that. They were kids, you know. They were like starting their life.
I mean,
they were in like this hopeful, like a lot of them were seniors, and it was this feeling of like, we're about to go into the world. And like,
I mean, the first case I covered on this podcast in COA's nursery when we knew nothing, we still know nothing, but was about Lauren Spear. And Lauren Spear is a young woman who disappeared when I was at Indiana University mm-hmm. the summer I was there. And there is this feeling of being in a college town. I mean, you went to Yonk, I went to Indiana University, and I know Idaho. Like, when you're in a college town, you feel invincible because the whole town is for you. It's like your playground, yeah. right? Like yeah, everything, all so the businesses, true. all the bars.
It does feel like nothing can happen.
It feels like nothing can happen because everybody is like this youthful, everybody's just trying to find their sea legs, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. it's the first time you're living on your own and you have your own house. But again, like as a parent too, you feel safe bringing your kid to these college towns because it's built for them to sort of, it's like living with training wheels on. And so the stealing of innocence of those communities. I remember in Bloomington, Indiana, I could walk. I was freaked out because it was quiet, but like I could walk late at night from my friend's house to my house.
Yeah.
And after this young woman disappeared, I would make my male friends walk me home because I just didn't feel safe. And I think,
and I can't
as women
imagine
too,
that,
it's
how
just
they're
so
feeling in Idaho after this.
I mean, think about this too. This happened. I mean, mine was, in my case, it was a young woman who disappeared. This was people that were murdered in their homes, and nobody was arrested until December. Like,
and
the
I think,
amount
do you think,
of time,
like, safety and numbers in this way too, where like no yeah. one's alone. It's like a big house with a
exactly.
ton of people in it.
Exactly.
And it like, reminds people, me of Ted Bundy did the same. He killed like a bunch of kids that were in their dorm or their, mm-hmm. you know, and some of them lived and a bunch of them got killed. And it was,
it's all random,
but so like brazen.
Yeah.
And that's part of the scary factor, is it feels like it's a person that's taking a big swing, and that feels even more unpredictable and like,
well,
their appetite for killing is so much more serious than even thinking of beyond like what an opportunity looks like. It's just like, oh, I'm going to kill. Like, I'm a killing machine.
Well, it's also that thing in this moment. I just can't imagine the rest of the student population in Idaho after this too, or the people that were in the house. Cause you're like, oh yeah, to your point, safety numbers. Like, these two girls were in the same bed together. This other young woman had her boyfriend with her. There are things, those things, even the two friends who went downstairs and ended up sleeping with her friend, she did that for safety, and yet that didn't protect their friends. So it's this stripping of autonomy and this stripping of security, mm-hmm. even in numbers, there's nothing that could have prevented it. And that feels like, you know, for parents that are going, you know, don't walk home by yourself, but you're in your home. Mm. I thought that was a safe space. It's just like stripping away safe spaces is yeah. just, it's horrifying. And I can't imagine too, the like, the way people must have felt in that community after.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So sad. So sad. I mean, I think nowadays it probably is harder to be a serial killer, right? I think because of technology, because we have a lot of video footage, I don't know if I would say it's more or less rare, but for things to go unsolved from a contemporary standpoint.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, you know, Lauren Spear really stays with me, but also because we never found out what happened to her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, those poor kids. Ugh.
Well, sorry, you guys, but that is real.
Okay. We need to, where are you going? You're going to Clear Lake when?
We leave, well, it's a bunch of places, but we leave Monday.
So exciting. Yeah. Okay. Well, if I don't see ya, I'm going to a show tonight. And then wait, Matt's, I'm going to a show tonight. I'm going to see Giant Skybeam tonight, which should be fun. And then I'm working a wedding tomorrow.
Whoa. Hubba hubba.
Hubba hubba. At Industry City.
At GGC today.
Fun. Yeah. Party on.
Oh my God. My shift is insane. Can I just tell you?
Yeah.
Like, sometimes your shift will be like, carry this giant table and a box of 300 perfumes on your back and just do it for 20 blocks east to west in the sun and make sure the actor knows what they're doing and then walk back and then go into like this basement and hide behind a curtain and make sure someone knows what they're doing and then go back and get the table from the actor and you'll just be like, this was a hard day. This was a lot of walking. And today I'm meeting GGC team at lunch. So the first thing that happens is I sit down and eat a lunch.
Ugh,
then
dream.
I start the teams. Then I have to go test the gelato clue. So I go get gelato. Then I go hang out at a speakeasy that's giving out lemon cocktails and people are doing the clue that has to do with lemons. And then I go to the finish line, which is at another really cool bar, the Campbell in Grand Central. This is a great day.
It's a good day. And you know what? You also earn that day because of all the other shit days you have.
Yeah, I'm psyched. Yeah, yeah. Check it out. Check it.
Have fun giving people weird clues and enjoy the lunch and the... This sounds great for you. This is perfect.
And then I'm going sailing tomorrow morning.
That's so fun.
I'm going on their sailboat.
Ugh, what a lovely... This is great. Thumbs up all around.
Sailing. I'm really excited. I've never been on a sailboat, I don't think. I've been on a lot of boats. I don't know if I've been sailing.
I still don't know what starboard, port...
I'll know after
Jib.
Tomorrow.
You'll know. Give us a lesson. Okay, yep. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.